Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Adam Ragusea. Few structures inspire a greater mix of feelings than Boston's Prudential Center. From a distance, the Prue and its sister, the Hancock Tower, are the first things we see over top the horizon. They welcome us home when we've been away. Their dual silhouettes signify the city. And yet, the boxy 1960s Prudential Tower itself is rarely the object of affection. Architecture critic Ada Louise Huxtable called it shockingly unrelated to the city's size, standards, or style, a slick developer's model dropped into an urban renewal slot in any city USA, a textbook example of urban character assassination. But Yale University architectural historian Elihu Rubin wants us to take a second look at the Prue. More than a landmark, he calls it a historical beacon, representing a moment in downtown Boston's darkest days when one megacorporation made an unlikely investment in the future of cities. Rubin's new book is called Insuring the City, the Prudential Center and the Postwar Urban Landscape. We spoke at the foot of the tower.
Why did an insurance company want to get in the business of building huge marquee towers like this? I mean, I'm sure they could have built in any form that would have been most practical for them, and I kind of doubt that this was it.
Well, the insurance companies, more than many other corporations, had a very special interest in impressive architecture because they were selling something intangible, financial security. You cannot tell the history of architecture in the United States or anywhere without talking about insurance companies as patrons of those impressive buildings. The buildings were advertisements for what they sold.
And what did they sell?
They sold life insurance policies. They sold a sense of well-being. They sold sort of emotional security. I mean, insurance policies today are not as popular as they were in the 1950s. In the 1950s, it was considered the moral duty of the breadwinner to buy insurance. And insurance companies like Prudential become the biggest, the most powerful corporations in the world.
So the giant elongated shoebox that we're looking at right now is essentially the architectural equivalent of the Rock of Gibraltar.
That's exactly right. You know, Prudential, you know, was founded in 1875 and is still headquartered today in Newark. In the 1950s, they decided to break the whole thing up and build these regional home offices in cities across the country. They were building little rocks of Gibraltar, in some sense, little chips off the rock in all of these cities across the United States. First in Los Angeles in 1948, and then soon after in Houston, Jacksonville, Minneapolis, Chicago, and finally Boston with the Prudential Center, the Northeastern Home Office. It was exactly meant to be a little Rock of Gibraltar, or a not-so-little Rock of Gibraltar, that would serve as an advertisement for the Prue.
Yeah, because this is the biggest of those towers by far, right?
This is the biggest of all of those buildings individually, and it is much more vast and ambitious an urban redevelopment project than all of those other regional home offices were as well. In 1964, Fortune magazine reported that Prudential, MetLife, and AT&T are the three biggest corporations in the world. They have so much money, and what they called it in Fortune is the mighty pump. They draw all this money in insurance premiums, and now they have a responsibility to pump it all out as investments. The buildings used to house their own offices are one of those investments that they make. Not only, to house their own operations, but also as speculative office space. So when Prue built this building between 57 and 65 when it opened, they built it not only to house their Northeastern home office, but they also built it as spec office space. They had confidence that Boston was already or was going to continue to be an important city for the service economy.
And that's remarkable because in the 1950s and 60s, that confidence might not have been entirely grounded in fact. I mean, downtown Boston was a pit.
That's exactly right. And that's why Prudential's investment was so crucial to the city. Because Prudential came to Boston, the president, Carol Shanks, and says, "We believe in Boston. We believe in the entire New England region." And this was exactly at a time when cities like Boston, industrial cities of the Rust Belt, were really concerned about their future. The urban leaders of Boston, from politics and from business, they were concerned that the central city would become the donut hole in the middle of the suburban metropolis. the city is losing its tax base, both in terms of its residential tax base and its business property tax base. So when Prudential comes and say, we believe in Boston, that is big news for the city.
What was at this site before it?
This site was a railroad yard.
Really?
It was a fanning set of tracks that was being managed by the Boston and Albany Railroad, then owned by the New York Central. This is a really key part of the story, because in the 1950s, railroad companies like the Boston and Albany, the New York Central, were looking to capitalize on their urban real estate assets, because the corridors, the tracks, the yards, and the terminals were struggling in the 50s, as railroad commutation and railroad transportation in general is on the decline and automobile transportation is on the rise. So the railroad companies are in a quandary. What do they have? They have amazing tracts of land in the city. They were looking to sell as early as 1951. John Hines, the mayor, was looking for an investor to come in that could do something really big and impressive with this site. Who else but an insurance company would have the resources to build something this big at the scale of the railroad?
Reading your book, I had no idea that from the earliest days, this project was conceived of in terms that sound very familiar today. It was mixed use. It was new urban. It was density. It was all the things that developers try to sell their projects with today, and yet it popped up in the heart of the automobile era.
That's right. From the beginning, the vision was, we're going to do something more here than just build an office tower. For all of their projects, they had done stuff like this. For example, the Western Home Office on Wilshire Boulevard housed the Orbach's department store and street front retail. So they did have some experience doing mixed use. But at Pru, they said, there is a real need for urban housing. And this was a major program in urban redevelopment at that time, to build high-end, luxury-marketed apartment towers to try to attract those middle classes back into the city.
As early as the 1960s. Again, it sounds like you could be talking to me today.
Right, because today there is a major re-urbanizing trend, especially of professional class people.
We are standing on Boylston Street at the foot of the Pru, speaking to Elihu Rubin, author of the new book, Insuring the City, the Prudential Center, and the Postwar Urban Landscape. And Elihu, your book does make it clear that even though this was a project that was very dense and very urban, it was still an essentially automobile-era project.
That's exactly right. The Prudential Center is explicitly a highway-based project. In fact, we really should talk also about the Pike and the Pru,
which is underneath our feet as we speak.
Which is literally underneath our feet and built in conjunction from the get-go with the Prudential Center. They were planned together. They were engineered as a singular megastructure. They were built by the same group of contractors. Politically, they were entirely linked, and financially they are linked, because ultimately the Prudential Insurance Company ended up buying more than a quarter of the bonds that were necessary to finance the construction of the Boston extension of the Turnpike. So the Pru essentially paid for its own driveway, ultimately. There's a whole another subplot in this. It's in a whole different chapter in the book, which kind of pinwheels off, which is the politics of transportation planning in the 50s and 60s. Because a lot of transportation planners wanted to build not turnpikes, but freeways, especially after 1956, when the federal government is coming along with major, major funding to build freeways. So John Volpe, the governor at that time, says, what do we need a turnpike for when we can build a freeway? His rival is Callahan, William F. Callahan, the chief of the Turnpike Authority, who believes that the most efficient way to build a highway into the heart of Boston, which he genuinely believed was necessary to save and revive the future of the city, that the most efficient way of doing that would be his turnpike. And so why do we have a turnpike and not a freeway in downtown Boston? It's because the Pike was very closely aligned with the Pru. And the Pru eventually says, hey, you guys in Boston better work this out. Are you going to have a freeway? Are you going to have the turnpike? Hey, we don't really care. Just figure it out so we can go ahead with our project. And with that kind of time pressure, ultimately, Governor Volpe says, you know what? Build the Pike.
So that invites the question, is the Prudential Center an artifact of the automobile era of the mid-20th century, of that era of city building, or is it a precursor of the urban revitalization, new urbanist movement that we're living right now?
Wow, I love that question, because The Prue is a mirror of our times, I would say. It is a product of 1950s automobile era city building, and it has also been a resilient landscape, a flexible landscape that now reflects our turn back to density, our turn back to the city, our turn back to really the kind of more traditional, quote-unquote, or 19th century urbanity of a continuous walkable city. The Prue that was dedicated in 1965 is almost unrecognizable. There are very few remnants of the original design, except for the tower itself and the residential apartment towers here and elements of the hotel. Very few elements of the original design are still with us here today. The area has been completely renovated over the course of the 80s, 90s, and continuing today, actually. In fact, there are two new towers still slated for the Prudential Center. Where we're standing now on the north plaza of the Prudential Center, there's slated to be another tower here that will, in a sense, flesh out the Prue even further to help construct, not reconstruct, because there never was a street frontage here, but to construct a street frontage on Boylston Street.
That's fascinating, because one of the things that has always baffled me about the Prudential Tower is that on the street level, I feel like I can never get to it. I don't know where it is. I can walk back and I can see it, but I can never walk up to the point at which this giant building meets the street. It's unattainable.
That's exactly right. And that was one of the early criticisms of the Prue, that urbanistically it was out of touch, out of scale. It was an isolated enclave that sat back behind a moat, literally, because the tower itself was surrounded by a moat, but also by a ring road that circumnavigated the site. But in the 80s and 90s, with the renovations, buildings would eat into the ring road to kind of reconstruct the kind of density that we now associate, actually, with this Midtown district.
And so now, instead of a water moat, we have a retail moat.
Exactly. We have a retail moat, or this series, this sort of network of retail arcades.
All of that said, as I look up at this big old box, I'm reminded that people kind of hate this thing. The Globe's architecture critic Robert Campbell, frequent guest on this program, for years gave out the Prue Award to the building he hated the most from the year. So I'm curious, Elihu. Here we are, just two guys, year 2012. You look up at this thing. Do you like it?
I do like it. For me, the Prue has tremendous charm. A lot of people do not like the metal grate of the facade, the kind of ticky-tacky small windows of that facade. I don't know, maybe they want a smoother glass facade. Maybe they find more elegant the mirrored glass facade of the Hancock Tower, for example. Or maybe they appreciate the kind of subtle rhomboid shape, the subtle rhomboid site plan of the Hancock Tower. And here the Prue sits as a kind of dumb box with its square plan. And for those reasons, I think it has been vilified. When this was designed in the 50s, who knew what was good modernist architecture? I mean, these were all steel and glass rectangles, slabs in the sky. You know, it's kind of up for grabs what makes good modernist architecture. Now, I may be offending some art historians out there who have very clear ideas about what they think is good and bad in this stuff. My ideas are not so clear there. I think that if you're standing from across the Charles on Memorial Drive at twilight and you see the light glinting off the Prue Tower, it's as elegant as any other tower. Reasonable people can disagree as to whether they think it's beautiful, right? But at that time in the 50s, the architects, Charles Luckman Associates, a huge firm based in Los Angeles, and one of the arguments I make in the book is that, hey, this tower isn't designed by a singular artist. This isn't like Mies van der Rohe giving Boston a building in that sense. It is a tower built by committee. It is a tower built through a bureaucratic process of relationships between the lead architect, his whole team of architects, the client, the engineers, all of the many, many subcontractors. So this is not the work of a singular artist. It is the work of a committee. But at a certain point, one of the project architects, a guy called Charles Stanton, who ran Charles Luckman's New York office, he said they were going for a lacy, textured effect. They didn't want it to look like one of the modern buildings going up on Park Avenue at that time.
The totally smooth, monolithic surfaces of the international style.
Exactly. That's exactly right. They wanted more texture. And they actually even kind of thought it was a little bit more Bostonian, I think, because of the fact of this sort of small windows. I don't know.
It fits right in.
It fits right in. Exactly.
I tell you, I think I've been looking at this building differently ever since I started watching Mad Men. I'm 30 years old. I've never had a positive emotional connection to mid-century modernism. They've always just been the cold, concrete places my parents lived and worked in, as opposed to the coziness of the 19th century architecture or the cool look of the postmodern architecture. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I started watching Mad Men that I started to sort of get this positive emotional connection to that era of architecture. It started to look cool to me. I started to understand how futuristic it was, how sexy it was in its time. And if I look up there and I imagine Don Draper working in what is now Top of the Hub, I can get into it.
Good. I think that's right. That's exactly the kind of era that it was. There are a few buildings from mid-century modernism that have entered the canon of distinguished architecture. The Prudential Center is not one of them. And our discussion of it today is not meant to revive its reputation as good architecture, but it's meant to look at it so that we better understand some of the major trends in city building in the 50s and 60s, because it really does stand in for some of the most important trends of that time. And as we've discussed, it also stands in for some of the most important trends of today, of our time today.
Elihu Rubin, your book is called Insuring the City, the Prudential Center, and the Postwar Urban Landscape. It's a phenomenal document, and I've so enjoyed talking with you about it today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it as well. It was a lot of fun.
Coming up, some Independence Day history. Everybody knows about John Adams and John Hancock, but guess which other Massachusetts patriot signed the Declaration of Independence?
Elbridge Gerry, after whom comes the phrase gerrymandering.
Gerrymandering.
He lived in Marblehead. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence representing Massachusetts.
John Marcus, editor of MySecretBoston.com, dishes on some lesser-known 4th of July things to know, do, and see around town. Stay with us. I'm Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.